Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
I'm Fran, and you're listening to Business Lives Podcast by Vox Markets. Today we speak with Seth Maxwell. He is the CEO and founder of The Thirst Project, the world's leading youth water activism organization. Their mission is to build a socially conscious generation of young people who can end the global water crisis. They're focusing on education, activism, and mobilizing this new generation to provide communities around the world with safe drinking water. So hi, Seth. Thank you for coming on the podcast today. You run The Thirst Project, which is the world's largest youth water organization. The Thirst Project tackles the global problem of access to clean water. Just to familiarize our listeners with you and what you stand for, would you first tell us a little bit about your background? You know, when did you first develop an awareness of this crisis, and how integrated were these kinds of topics in your education or at home even?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the heart of who I am, I'm a storyteller. I've lived in Los Angeles for the last 12 years, but I grew up in Indianapolis, Indiana. And for most of my childhood, we moved quite a lot, but I loved just telling stories. And so from the time that I was about seven, my mom took me to my first audition. And, you know, I booked my first acting job in plays and did a lot of theater. And so as we moved around, bouncing from suburbs of Chicago back to Indianapolis, I did a lot of different theater. And so when I graduated high school and decided to move to Los Angeles to pursue a degree in theater, it's there that I learned first about the global water crisis. And it wasn't necessarily a huge topic of certainly not my education or necessarily even something that I grew up with at home. You know, I grew up going to church with my family. And so certainly there were conversations about, different elements of poverty internationally or different particular issues that groups struggled with in different communities for development, but had never really particularly learned a ton about the water crisis. And it was really while I was 19 that I was in school, and I had a friend who was a photojournalist who was the first person to expose me to the global water crisis specifically. She had left for the country for a trip that she was sent on to go document and report as an assignment on the progress on the UN's Millennial Development Goals. And so the MDGs have kind of since, I think, been reframed as the SDGs or Sustainable Development Goals. But when she came back after about a year and a half of being gone, which was kind of broken up into 6-week blocks in different communities or different villages for 6 weeks at a time across Southeast Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, South and Central America, she came back and we got together to catch up over coffee. And I sat across from her, sort of stunned for about 45 minutes as I watched, looking at picture after picture after picture of 3 and 4 and 5 year olds on the side of the road drinking water out of, mud puddles, rivers, swamps, water sources that were open, unprotected, that were shared with animals that both drank and defecated in the same water sources that people drank from. And it wasn't just poverty porn, like, oh, look at this sad kid. But she began to tell me stories of people who she'd really intimately befriended as she lived in these places for 6 weeks at a time. And it wasn't just like, oh, look at this, poor kid. It was, no, look, this is Sophie. She's 7. We hung out for 6 weeks. We played Barbies. I watched her drink from this river. I watched her struggle with or die from cholera. And the common through line she kept coming back to in her findings from this particular assignment was, it's great that we're building schools and places and trying to outfit them with teachers, but you can't educate a community if all of your kids in that community are either sick with easily preventable waterborne diseases and unable to attend school, or even more commonly, are out walking 6 to 8 hours each day just to fetch and collect dirty water. You can't bring agricultural development to a community and try to combat hunger with food security without first having water. And so she said, the common thing I kept finding was like, the prioritization of these things has been a little bit out of whack. If you care about education, you care about water. If you care about hunger, you care about water. And that was really the first time I learned about the global water crisis. And at that point, it used to be that 1.1 billion people didn't have access to safe, clean water. So today, about a decade later, it's 663 million. But it's been a pretty crazy crazy journey.
Crazy and a long way to go, clearly. How did you go about forming the business originally and kickstarting your own activism?
So, like most 19-year-olds, I didn't really start or really set out to start a charity. After learning about this, I went to school the next day and was just talking to my friends. And I was like, guys, you have no idea what's going on in the world. You know, we have to do something. I was arguably the most selfish, kind of introspectively focused human being on the planet. I really didn't care about anything unless it had to do quite directly with the entertainment community. And so my friends and I did what most 19-year-olds do when you're passionate about something. You start a club. And so I started a group on our school campus aimed at just raising awareness of the global water crisis in our city and in our community. And we started doing little events to try to get people's attention and just share and have conversations and tell this story to people that I knew probably didn't know it any more than I did at that point. I considered myself to be a fairly well-educated then 19-year-old and was sort of struck by just how massive in scale this issue was and how I'd never heard anything about it. And so initially, we just started doing events. We pitched in all the money we had between the seven of us, which at that point was about $70. We went to our nearest grocery store, and one of our friends was the manager there. And we basically begged them to give us a crazy discount on bottled water. And one of the first things we did was, load my friend Will's pickup truck up with about 1,000 bottles of water. And we went out to Hollywood Boulevard and started giving away free water so that people would talk to us and stop and say, why are you doing this? So we could say to them, did you know? Did you know this is happening? Did you know this is going on around the world? And so in that day in particular, people started giving back money for the bottles of water that they took. We were able to turn $70 into about $1,700, which we donated to another organization that at the time was building water projects. And, we kind of thought that was it. We really tried to have meaningful conversations with people. We filled gas cans up full of water and challenged people to carry them just to the Gap store and back just to see what it would be like if they were forced to carry and rely on heavy local water sources. We had conversations with people about what the water crisis was. But apart from raising that awareness and raising that money, that's kind of all we thought we were going to do. We didn't have a plan. We literally got a ticket for being there that day without a permit and, leaving water, stacks of water on the ground. But there were two people that met us that exchanged information with us and said, hey, would you guys come to our school and basically tell our friends what you told us? We want to see if we can do something similar. So we said, okay, sure, got my friends' photos, went and spoke at these two schools, kind of forgot about it until about a month later, they had done fundraisers and checks showed up for about $12,000. And they, were made out to the Thirst Project, but we didn't even have a bank account. Like, we couldn't deposit them. And that was when we realized, man, if this is what two schools could do, what if there were 10 schools, 100 schools, 1,000 schools? And so we realized that there was tremendous untapped potential in people our age around this issue. And no one was really reaching that population and trying to activate them. And so we created the Thirst Project.
Wow. So was that the kind of initial emphasis in terms of building a socially conscious generation of maybe specifically young people before this then translated into physically going to these countries and, building tangible evidence of your charity making a difference?
So I think initially, like many, whether nonprofit or for-profit entrepreneurial endeavors, I think we've kind of built the rocket ship as it was flying. I think we had a lot of ideas of what it could be, but really our goal was just how do we reach as many people as possible with this message, particularly young people our age who don't know about it, and then challenge them to raise funds that we can use to build real water projects for people who need it most. And so that first year, we started our school tour, which at the time went to about 10 schools. Today, fast forward 10 years later, our school tour has four different teams of two speakers each who, in any given day, are in four different schools across the country in the United States. Sometimes collectively they'll do 2 a days or more. So sometimes we're in 8, 9, 10 schools a day. But collectively this year, the school tour will go to well over 520 campuses, well over 100,000 students will sit in an assembly and learn about the water crisis through, you know, media rich content, lots of documentary style short videos, as well as, you know, trying to find devices that package and tell the story of the water crisis in a way that is meaningful and spurs young people to action. But, you know, part of what we talk about is, yes, like trying to build a socially conscious and active generation of young people. But the, you know, the emerging generation, Gen Z and beyond, like they don't really need to be taught to be socially conscious. What we have found, though, is so many people in schools and students especially really need tools to be shown, man, this is a meaningful way you can channel your consciousness into action and activation, and it's going to make a meaningful impact on this issue. And so, you know, to your question, like the first year, we did a lot of focus on just building out that school tour and trying to raise funds. And the first 2 years as an organization, we were exclusively a funding organization. So that's to say, we would raise money and then we would go give it to other groups that would build water projects, whether it was World Vision, Living Water International, Concern Worldwide US, et cetera. But from there, we realized there were pretty significant differences in how each of those groups were building water projects internationally. And so we candidly didn't know what we didn't know. And so we began asking, well, why is it that, you know, you guys do hydrology and groundwater surveys before you drill your projects, but you guys don't? Or why is it that you guys do water quality tests, but you guys don't? Or why is it that you guys elect and train water committees, but you guys don't? And so we kind of pushed pause for about a year, from year two until year three, continued to fundraise, but we stopped funding pretty much any water project. And we built what today is called our Water Project Technical Board. So it's a group that's similar to our actual board, but unlike our actual board of directors, who, you know, very sort of carefully scrutinized finances and program growth and development, they couldn't really care less about that. Their focus is solely on how we build water projects sustainably in the field, where we build, what types of projects get approved or denied for intervention, and the strategy behind each of those. And it's a group of, you know, three civil engineers and four hydrologists who have, you know, collectively got PhDs in their backgrounds. Most of them either own or work for their own for-profit green civil engineering firms, and have spent a good deal of time working, you know, in the field overseeing these types of projects as well. And so they meet once a quarter and review the data submitted from our staff on the ground in the field in the countries that we work in to either approve or deny communities for intervention based off of need, prioritize them, and then determine the types of projects we'll build there. But, you know, that wasn't always the case. It took about two years or so to get to that place, from going from a funding organization to actually building all of our own projects and employing, you know, full-time teams or staffers who are from those countries that we work in on the ground to lead those initiatives with the communities that we work with.
And in terms of how you differentiate yourself from other social enterprises, do you think this emphasis on a younger generation being these sort of powerful agents, do you think that is where you stand and where you're different?
Absolutely. I mean, we believe with everything in us that young people are the most powerful agents for social change in the world, full stop. And it's not just a slogan that sounds good on a bumper sticker. I mean, we live it out. So like I said, this year, our school tour will go to about 100,000 students, but that's just the students that we can physically go speak to. So we can't necessarily afford to go speak at all of the schools that we work with. So this year, we'll work with collectively about 360,000 predominantly high school, some college and university, and some lower education students, but students who will do dances, walks, video game tournaments, all in their local communities to activate them, to raise awareness and funds to build water projects. And it's honestly incredible when you see what happens after you take this issue in front of a group of students and young people. The creativity, the innovation, the generosity and selflessness that these students have as they architect what it is that they want to do to try to raise awareness of these issues and drive support to build water projects for people who need it most around the world is honestly incredible. And so that's definitely the focus. I mean, like I said, we're not the oldest water organization in the world, and we're certainly not the largest, but we definitely are, if not the only, certainly the largest youth water organization. And so we do commit as well to give 100% of all the money that students raise directly to building water projects on the ground. So we have a pretty incredible group of donors and sponsors led by our board who fund all of our operating expenses so that we can tell those students that all their money goes to build water projects. But students are incredible.
Yes, and you yourself were a student when you started this. You were 19, and sort of running a business as a social entrepreneur requires a certain level of expertise and leadership and commitment, and more so, I guess, considering the global impact of your company. How did you find that when you started out? You know, did you have any guidance with that?
So I think for me, one of the best things I did and hopefully still continue to do as a leader in the organization is know all of the many, many things that I am not good at all, and find people who are excellent at those things, and then do the one thing I'm pretty good at, which is telling a story and convincing those people to join us, whatever capacity that is, whether it's as a board member to provide guidance and support financially, whether it's as a staffer to give up, you know, maybe a better paying job to come work and do this, build this vision, build this group. And so for me, so much of leading this organization has been bent around me finding those people on whom I could lead and say, hey, you know, I need your business acumen. I need your skills in finance. I need your skills in marketing to come around the table and build this project. And I think that, you know, for me, kind of the crux of what I've tried to do the most of is really challenge people who are, in some cases, you know, what I hope are some of the best in their field, to give up something good, whether that's a good paying job or whether it's, you know, time that they otherwise wouldn't have been volunteering or money they otherwise wouldn't have been giving to this, in the name of something great. And I think people are, you know, tired, to quote Dan Pallotta, I think people are tired of being asked to do the least amount possible for the causes and things that matter the most in the world. And so for me, you know, as far as like having business acumen, I've certainly learned a great deal in the last decade from leading this organization, but it is completely to the credit of, you know, predominantly our board, who we assembled, who are incredible business leaders and leaders in entertainment and finance and operations, who have come around the table and architected the systems that we have in place for us to lead and work with.
How long did that take to implement? And back to this challenge aspect, what kind of challenges did you face personally when you started the project from the beginning? And how did you overcome these?
I think some of the initial challenges were a lack at that point of proof of concept, both in myself as a leader and in just the work, being a 19-year-old and saying, hey, we're going to go build water programs, water systems, water wells, wash programs in developing communities around the world to get people who don't have it access to safe, clean water, comes with a lot of very natural and understandable questions of how do you plan to do that? What is what sort of qualifies you to do that? And, you know, I think, again, thankfully, some of the challenges that we had early on, we were able to overcome simply with, if nothing else, just persistence. We didn't take no for an answer, or I didn't take no for an answer. And so when someone said, I can't help you, or this is maybe not what you should be doing and focusing on, we just ignored it, which, you know, not to go back too much to students and young people, but I mean, that is the most powerful thing a student and young person has on their side, is the capacity to ignore all of the reasons why they quote unquote can't do it. Students, much like 19-year-old me, like, don't know what they don't know. And so they don't know that it's an audacious, ridiculous thing to say that a bunch of students will end what we believe to be the single greatest humanitarian crisis the global community faces today, but we believe it. And so I think, you know, for me, my biggest challenges early on were just trying to figure out, man, how do I find people with the background and experience with candidly the money and financial resources we need, and then convince them to bring those things to the table. And once we began to build that group, you know, our first board was only five people. And the initial ask of those five people was basically $5,000 a year to cover the cost of our school tour. You know, there were no paid staffers. There was no, you know, budget for really any operations. As time grew, you know, our board today is 15 people who, between their operations commitment of $25,000 and their, you know, fundraising commitment of another $25,000 for water projects, each board member represents about a $50,000 per year commitment, which, you know, is no small amount. And it's very much sort of a self-selecting group, but it took a decade to build that out. And then from there, similarly, you know, our corporate partnerships, it's sort of challenging to walk into a brand and say, hey, we got this idea, you know, will you give us support? And so I think it took time building out the school tour and building scale and showing, hey, we have an army of, you know, a couple hundred thousand young people who are working on this, who have demonstrated proof of concept, time over those years, building out relationships on the ground with those staffers who lead those projects in the field and build them alongside the drilling companies we hire and the communities we work with, to show that proof of concept and show that it's working. And so really, we didn't have any of that in the beginning. It was a lot of, and you know, sort of to the testament of those people who still gave their time, gave their money, gave their acumen early on when we didn't have any of that. You know, those people were such a gift, who saw the vision and sewed into and believed in the vision. It's sort of easy, to come alongside something when it's, you know, polished and flying well. It takes a little bit more to come alongside something and say, hey, you're not quite there. You're making some mistakes, but I see what you're building for and building towards, and I want to help you. And so that was some of our earlier challenges, was just finding those people and convincing them to come along the table.
Yes. And sort of along the same lines, did you find any barriers being a 19 millennial entrepreneur? And from that, what advice would you give to young adults wanting to start a, you know, not necessarily nonprofit, but their own organization, whether that be a social enterprise or leadership skills in general?
I think that you know, most people naturally assume if you are a young person trying to build or lead anything, whether it's a social venture, for-profit venture, that the thing that will be to your greatest disadvantage is your youth. But I couldn't believe more firmly that that's wrong. You know, and so I think for me, I think the greatest single advantage competitively you have going for you, if you are a young person in your, you know, 19, 20s into early 30s, is the fact that you can go approach something and say, hey, here's a problem that we look at and we want to tackle in a way that's not being done before. And the advantage that you have is most people, even the younger you are especially, don't know often how to respond when a passionate, articulate 19-year-old comes in and says, hey, I want to tackle hunger. I want to tackle homelessness. I want to tackle this thing. And they're not just sort of cute and 19, but they are sharp and prepared and have a concrete plan with proof of concept to back it up and say, hey, here's what we're going to do together. If you come alongside me, we're here, but we could be here. And so I definitely faced, you know, some challenges early on with people saying, like, you know, you have a degree in theater, or, you know, you didn't study nonprofit management, you didn't study business, you know, kind of what, you didn't study water or development, you know, what kind of background do you have that sort of justifies you doing this? But I think for me, again, my approach to overcoming some of those initial questions or challenges was just honesty and transparency and saying, like, hey, yeah, I don't, you know, I'm good at this thing, but I've got this guy who is a hydrologist. I've got these guys who are, you know, incredible leaders in business, whether they're the president of a movie studio or whether they are the president of a company, and they're guiding this process. I've got this guy. And so I think leaning into, and rather than trying to hide or apologize for that, but rather leaning into it and saying, yeah, you're right, but I've got this. And this is who I am and this is where we're going, sort of drive that.
How are you making sure that you are linking, you know, the tangible work that you're doing in these countries digitally so you can spread this awareness to young people across the world?
So we place a really high value on how we tell people's stories at Thirst Project. And for us, It's really important when we send anyone into the field to capture people's stories, both that it is as ethical as possible and as humanizing in the way that we present those people's stories as possible, but also that as we then craft that content on the back end for our audience, that it's done in such a way that is as palatable and understandable for a young audience as possible. The goal is not necessarily how do we create a documentary that's been, fits the format of every other documentary before, or every other piece of, social media content that's been used by organizations doing work internationally before. The question is much more driven by, how do we tell this story in a way that's going to resonate with a young person and move them to act? And so in trying to check both of those boxes, the challenge is always, how do we make this girl seem like she could be the girl sitting next to you at your locker or in the auditorium, not a girl that's on the other side of the world, in most cases in a situation or dealing with a challenge that you have no concept or thankfully have never had to experience anything like, right? But how do we both A, humanize this girl in a way that makes her seem as relatable as possible and highlights the ways that she is just like you and moves you to connect with her, but then also moves you to act. And it's definitely a challenge, striking all of those balances. We really try to ensure, we don't generally, if ever, show people in what we would consider to be their worst. So when we're trying to tell the story of the water crisis, whether it's about the challenges of walking for long hours and distances to collect dirty water, whether it's the impact on your health from drinking dirty water, we don't show images of kids that, have flies on their eyes and, when the clothes are ripped. It's really working with communities that we work with to try to find the most honoring and ethical and humanizing way to tell those stories while still being honest about the reality of the impact of the water crisis in those communities. And it's a real challenge. But the ways that we tell stories also from the perspective of what our students are doing about it in an attempt to move them to get involved as well has also shifted. So it used to be for the first few years, I was the speaker on the school tour. And part of what works about sending a young person in to go speak at these schools is there's something powerful about a peer standing on stage saying, you don't have to have more money, you don't have to be older, you don't have to have a higher education even to try to tackle these issues. And the reality is 10 years later, I'm 30, and so it's not as effective. And so it's always a funny when people say oh, really, you're too old. But the reality is, yes, 30-year-old me does not resonate with a 14-year-old or a 17-year-old the way that 19-year-old me did. And so in terms of how we tell that story to students, we are intentional about finding young activists who are either just out of college, maybe taking a semester off of college, or just out of high school in between college, who we bring to LA to actually be the speakers on these school tours. We train them and they head out on these epic road trips across the country to go deliver these messages and these stories to these students to move them to act. But it's definitely shifted over the years.
Yes, and going back to, the girl who could be your next door neighbor or sitting in a classroom with you, I guess you're sort of bridging the gap, which is more effective. In terms of since you started when you were 19, what progress have you seen? But more specifically, what are you most proud of?
Goodness. In a broad sense, we've been able to work with local communities to build water projects on the ground in 13 countries, giving about 350,000 people safe, clean water for the rest of their lives. And so in terms of impact, though, we don't really measure success in dollars raised or number of projects built or even number of people that have been, given safe water. For us, success is really measured much more granularly than that. So for us, looking at a community, and if we can say before we built a project in this community, the data we had showed that there was a 29% rate of schistosomiasis, or there were 5 incidences of cholera the month before, or, 1 waterborne related death due to cholera or dysentery or diarrheal diseases the month before, and then subsequently after that, we can say, you know, after we built these projects, we now can show that those rates of infection have dropped from 29% to 4%, and five incidences to one incident, and, you know, one mortality to zero in a month. That for us is success. If we can look at a community and say, you know, we know conclusively that before we built this project, there were only 38 students or children from the village that were enrolled in school, and it could have been for a variety of reasons, but also, you know, not the least of which could have been that these students spent hours each day walking to get water, and they no longer have to do that. And we can now say that the number of students enrolled in school have increased from 38 to, you know, 89. That for us is success. And so those are some of the things that I'm the most proud of, is the things that are sometimes harder to package in storytelling. It's easy to go, we've raised $10 million and given 350,000 people safe water. That sounds really great. But without knowing the impact of it, it doesn't necessarily mean as much. And so I think for me, the things that I'm the most proud of are being able to go into those communities that we work with and say, we truly do work with these communities. You know, our sustainability practices are incredibly stringent. They go back to that water project technical board that I talked about. And we really do try to work with communities. It's never sort of a group of Westerners flying in saying, hey, we're going to give you a bunch of stuff and leaving, but rather really working with communities to architect the solutions and the WASH programs that we build, being water and sanitation and hygiene in these communities, hiring local contractors, working with local community members to build them out. And so I think that's, you know, again, one of the things I'm the most proud of is the ability to work with those communities as ethically as possible, while still remaining honest and effective.
Yes, wonderful. If you could single out a valuable bit of information that you would pass on to someone interested in leading a successful nonprofit or even joining, what would that be?
So for me, it's always an interesting question because it's somewhat, my answer, at least along the lines of beginning or leading your own nonprofit, may seem initially somewhat hypocritical, which is, if someone says, how, you know, what would your advice be on, you know, how do I start a nonprofit? My answer usually is don't, which likely seems very hypocritical. But the follow-up to that is, unless what you are going to lead or begin is going to be one of these five things, it's going to be the first, the only, better, faster, or cheaper in some way than some other group that is already addressing the issue that you're trying to address, then don't start something new. Go use your resources, go use your relationships, go use your capital and acumen to build something that's already being built, that's already serving the populations you want to serve. However, if there is a capacity to say it's going to be the first, the only, better, faster, or cheaper, then, you know, by all means, then start. But we have so many, just in the United States alone, I mean, so many 501c3s incorporated every year that exist to address the same issues. And so the challenge is you have a lot of, in most cases, very small groups that are under-resourced, under-experienced, under-equipped, trying to spend so much time just collecting resources to survive that don't necessarily make their way to addressing the problems they want to address. Whereas if we were to combine and collectively add our resources, we could make such greater impact together. And so that's sort of my first thought around starting a nonprofit. But if you're looking at joining and building a group, you know, the natural first question should always be, what is it that you care about the most? What is it that, you know, what is the issue that breaks your heart? What is the issue that you look at and say, man, it is unthinkable that we would spend another minute here, that we would allow this to happen for another minute, and then work with what you have in your hand, what you have around you that you're good at to move that issue along.
Wonderful. Just to sort of round off, what do you hope people will take away from hearing about the Thirst Project and your story?
You know, obviously I am biased, but I believe with everything in me that the global water crisis is the single most pressing humanitarian crisis we face as a global community today because of how it impacts every single other philanthropic or development initiative that you could care about. So like I said earlier, if you care about education, you care about water, if you care about hunger, you care about water. And I think probably the most encouraging thing is the progress being made towards the issue. You know, obviously it is still massive in scale, but since we started over a decade ago, the number of people without safe water globally has been cut in half while the global population has risen. So it's not a question. We will see the end of this issue, not just in our lifetimes, in the next 15, maybe 20 years. It is just a question of how quickly we can move that ball down the field. And so I hope that people hearing will say, man, I want to get involved. I want to give, whether that's give your time, give your expertise, give your financial resources, whatever that looks like, to helping move this ball down the field. Like I said, we're by no means the only group addressing this issue, because it is so massive in scale, like no one agency could tackle all of it. But I hope people hear it and both A, choose to get involved, and B, are inspired for the world that we're working to build that we'll see in the next 15, 20 years.
Fantastic. And if anyone listening wants to get involved with the Thirst Project, where can they find you?
So a few different ways. You can just find us at thirstproject.org, or all of our social handles are just at Thirst Project. And if you're interested in getting involved, you can just text the keyword thirst to 97779. It's not a donation prompt. It won't prompt you to give or charge your phone automatically, but someone from Thirst Project will reach out to you and say, hey, thank you so much for texting in. Here's information on how you can bring us to your school, how you can volunteer, how you can donate, and learn more.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Seth. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Really, really nice to have you on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.